people. It is a Starship Rokon show with Anna DeBlantis for another day of broadcast insolence. Richard Roper is here today. Anna is off, celebrating a prolonged Easter weekend. A lot of people have today off. And we start right now. We have Susie Sunshine, Susan Schmidt from Westwood in Dallas, in studio with us on her way back to Dallas. But we stopped her. Literally, we stopped her plane, dragged her off. We got the City of Chicago Aviation Police to do it for
That's
us.
Nice.
And brought her back into the studio here just to discuss what has happened today. And specifically, how this affects people in our listening area, which I think is really important. The Chinese, obviously, the Dow down, as you just heard Judy mention, Dow down 459, I think, was it?
So about 2%.
Yeah. And it
and the S&P also, because remember, watch the S&P, and it was broader base, also
right.
Down about 2%.
But you know, as a temperature, I know that you have to tell me that because you know more about it than we do. But the reality is that people look at that big top number, and it was down much more significantly earlier today. Now, when I think the thing that is going to get the attention of a lot of people in Illinois and Wisconsin and Iowa is when the Chinese targeted pork.
Right.
As one now, of the big 25% tariff on pork.
Right. We talked about this because steel sounds good, but we don't really import a lot of steel. And we certainly don't export a lot of steel. So if a country wants to retaliate against us on tariffs, they're not going to pick steel. They're going to pick something that we're really big in. Well, we're really big in agriculture. So that includes the proteins. It includes the grains. And this is a normal volley back. Unfortunately, it's now coming into reality. We're starting to talk specifics and actual, here's pork. Here's one of the things. You know, it could be beef. It's going to be soybeans. We see these tariffs coming back at us. This is what it's like to be on the receiving end. So it's causing a lot of volatility in the market. It's going to cause a lot of concern. Nothing here is set in stone. This is all still volleying back and forth, and it's a lot of commentary right now. It's not actual numbers yet, but we're going to see how this evolves out, and it's going to be complicated. I think it is one of the many undertones that is contributing to the volatility in the market.
Okay, well, as we see this happen now, like, I mean, it was almost predictable today, right, that the markets would go down on this news over the weekend. And the futures for, you know, the market futures are down here, especially when it comes to ag. You also have Amazon as the other big play
here.
Right,
so we talked about tech a little bit last week. There's a lot of pressure on tech. Tech was one of the best performing sectors last year, and at the beginning of this year, it's not unusual for people to take a look at their best performing sectors and say, you know, it did so well, I'm now overweight that sector, I'm going to pull some money off the table. And so we started to see that anyway. We're still seeing people offload some of that tech exposure, and they're moving to the side. The big headlines, particularly now about Amazon is one of the leaders in tech. So we talk about the tech stocks. Amazon is helping to lead that down. That's also a big position for these indices, which is why you're seeing that big movement in the S&P and the Dow.
Very technical. This is very technical what's going on here. This is very.
This is from the man who tried to address the yield curve last week.
Yeah, sure.
That's true. Yeah. But I mean, but the point is that you have to think like a trader here.
You have to think like a trader. There's a lot of near-term pressure. And then just headlines are a bad thing. You know, big negative headlines are a bad thing for any stock that you hold because obviously there's a knee-jerk reaction to that. Many traders are going to sell first and dig into what it really means later. So let's get away from the noise. And this is one of the things that we're seeing. It's a lot of volatility. The trade talks, ongoing discussions around tariffs are going to increase the level of volatility because that's going to impact a lot of different areas. Electronics is a huge export for us. And so that is yet another reason why we're seeing some weakness in tech.
But Susan, you talk about knee-jerk reactions. There are often knee-jerk reactions to the knee-jerk reactionary in chief, in charge.
Yes.
Who often seems to be tweeting, it seems very clear that he's just learning something that he should already know. And then he's telling us because he just learned it, possibly by watching,
news.
I don't know if it's Channel 265 in his cable market, but the Fox, his friends at Fox. So, you know, you get that, and often it feels, and both of these topics we're talking about, is he doesn't think through what's going to happen. It's just, I just found this out. This doesn't seem right. I'm going to fix it.
Right. And so there are a lot of repercussions. You know, you throw a pebble into the water, and you're going to get multitudes of ripples. And so we're seeing that, and it really does impact the markets, and we're seeing that ripple effect through the market. So again, the markets don't like to be surprised. They don't know what happens when this gets elevated to a single point in Washington and the administration is focused on it without thinking about all the other ancillary items that can be impacted. So that is, you know, a cause for concern. The market did a really good job for a long time of ignoring what was happening in Washington and just going along. And now we're starting to see the headlines from Washington catch up with the emotions on the market, and now we're seeing that interaction. I think one of the good things that
Real consequence here. I mean, when there was all this talk about people were the markets were awaiting, especially for big American companies, they were awaiting the tax deal. They wanted
a huge positive, and that is set. It's ongoing. That is still a big positive. So we've had a nice
and that keeps
stock
us in the 24,000s in the
right, and that is and now we one of the positives coming up is we're going to have companies start reporting earnings pretty soon. We just finished the quarter. Give us 3 weeks. You're going to hear companies out talking about how the quarter went for them, what they see for the coming year. That can all be very positive news, and the market is going to be very tuned in to what those management teams are saying. Okay. Because it's focused on how those businesses are doing. That ultimately is what drives the market. The up and down in the interim can be very bumpy, but it's noise.
All right. The question is, will there be pressure to break up Amazon now? And if you break up Amazon, that is not going to bring back your corner bookstore, I don't think. I'm very certain of that, actually.
Get me Croc and Brentano on a speed dial.
Exactly. Yes, no, the corner bookstore is not coming back. I think what we're seeing here, and we've talked about it, we've touched on this when we talked about the change in retail, the change in consumer preferences and how people are shopping. That's happened. You can't turn back that tide. And so it's highly unlikely that we're going to be breaking up these big companies right now. But we are going to be digging into it, and you're going to see more headlines, positive and negative, coming out of it.
Yes. Although you can get Tide on sale at Amazon, and they deliver it right to your house in bulk.
But they're not for snacking. Right. Remember that.
Yes, exactly. Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Susie Sunshine.
Thanks, Susie.
Susan Schmidt, Senior Vice President, Senior Portfolio Manager, Westwood in Dallas. Right now, Judy, what's coming up at the bottom of the hour?
A little night baseball in the frozen north. White Sox baseball is back. They're battling the Blue Jays in Toronto tonight. That's tonight at 6 on WGN TV Sports.
Undefeated Chicago White Sox, by the way. As soon as they joined WGN's family, the minute they did that, they can't lose a game.
Leading the entire American League.
That's right. How about
nobody
that?
Nobody else is undefeated.
A.B. Stoddard joins us right now on the Super Celebrity Hotline. And A.B., I don't even know where to begin.
Now more than ever, we need A.B.
I know. I don't even know. It is so frightening to me. Just waking up is frightening to me now.
This is true.
You know, it used to be, I mean, I know, like our progenitors, when they woke up, they were like, yay, I survived the night. You know, and now you wake up, you go, don't look at your phone, don't look at your phone, don't look at your phone.
That's true.
All right, so the president goes on a bit of a tweet storm on a number of different issues today, but I want to stick. We were just talking to our financial analyst about Amazon. He's now opened up the box and monkeying with the wires, isn't he?
Yeah, it's really amazing. I don't recall this being a major campaign theme, but he's really obsessed, and I think it's making people a little nervous. And once again, Republicans are silent. You can just imagine if Obama was beating up on a major engine of the economy, what they would have thought about that, using a perch of government power to intervene in the private market. But he's got it in his head that this great economy that he says is performing so well is somehow adversely affected, and we should all be very worried about the fact that Amazon, which we all know this has happened years ago, has put some brick-and-mortar stores out of business. And he's upset about the post office, and he gets a lot of his facts wrong, but that doesn't matter. So he's just hung up on this, and it'll take days for him to move on to something else. But, if you read Axios and some other reporting, about, you know, well-sourced reporting. You know, he's not concerned at all, as you can tell from his public comments and his tweets, with Facebook the way the rest of the world is right now. He's just solely focused on Jeff Bezos, the Washington Post, and Amazon.
Anything that helps him. I mean, this the thing that I think we're getting to understand in a real sort of real politic way is this idea of how this affects Donald Trump. He wakes up in the morning and goes, now how does whatever is in front of him affect me, good or bad? Mm-hmm. And if it's bad, we must smote. If it's good, we must laud. And so, obviously, Amazon is related to the Washington Post, mm-hmm. because Jeff Bezos, who is the chairman of Amazon, owns the majority of the Washington Post now. So even though they're not connected as companies, they have that one concentric piece in Jeff Bezos. So it's easy to beat up. This is a good way to try to, if he goes after the Jeff's, you know, real business, maybe he can exert some pressure on the Washington Post. Secondarily, he has, you know, he's got China. Anybody who's in, you know, he's in a bad mood about now, China's up the ante on him. Well, you know what is most interesting to me? Do you know what the story of the day is to me? It's not here. It's not in the United States. It's actually in Pyongyang, North Korea, where the South Korean K-pop group, whose name I cannot pronounce, performed for Kim Jong-un. And he was said to be delighted by it. Mm. And K-pop is that, you know, like that Psy guy, right? You know, Gangnam Style and all that sort of thing. So there was this young group of, like, you know, 5 or 6 kids lip-syncing away in front of Kim Jong-un. Mm. And now, this is the kind of music that if you were in North Korea, you'd get arrested and jailed for listening to if you illegally downloaded it. But he enjoyed it. There is a thaw here between North and South Korea. You can make the argument that Donald Trump would certainly make the argument that all of his tough rhetoric is doing that. And that may well be true. But what his tough rhetoric is doing is it's making friends amongst people who don't necessarily want to incur the wrath or or engage with Donald Trump in any kind of a real way. So at the behest of China, North and South Korea are getting together, which makes who the power broker in this? China.
Obviously the Chinese. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. It's it's an amazing moment if you think about the confluence of our national security challenges/crises and the economy and what he's doing on trade, because he's really coaxing the Chinese into this retaliation at this time when he thinks he's about to sit down with Kim Jong-un, and the Chinese are going to be a major broker in that. He also has told us, as we all remember, the trade wars are good and they're so easy to win. So trying to sort of game out where the next 6 weeks is going to go as the Koreas warm to each other and get along, which we can all take as a positive sign, we don't know where this other strain is, whether it's going to be resolved, whether it's going to triple what it's going to do to our economy, to the markets, and then obviously to this kind of hope for a resolution or some kind of diplomatic pause or truce on North Korea. It's just very serious things are done in unserious ways. And a year more than in this administration, more than a year into it, we're just supposed to, accept that it's fine. I mean, he's Theresa May is, you know, panicking over in the UK. Our greatest alliance is under all of the strain that they're trying to, you know, they want to keep it as private as possible, but you cannot invite Putin over here for a summit at the White House.
Oh, yeah, that happened today,
when
too.
She's trying to, you know, garner international support against the Putin government.
Yeah. You know, the interesting thing here, our two greatest rivals of the past, of the post-World War II era, have been China and Russia, right? We've been strategically on opposite sides of a number of different conflicts. They've been involved in all the conflicts we've been involved in. We've been involved in all the conflicts that they've been involved in, and we've always been on the opposite side of it. And now, we've done pretty well in terms of, you know, beating back, at least Russia's gains, because Russia's economy is 1/15 the size of the American economy. China, though, is now, you know, as big an economy, almost as big an economy as the United States, and in some factors bigger, and will be bigger by fairly soon, potentially. They're winning here. The United States was the big guy on the block, and you can't. And he's taken his eye off the ball of how we actually compete by triangulating here. He's allowing the United States to be triangulated. I'm not overstating this. That just look at what is happening here. Russia has outsized influence now in the world. It scares people because of its cyber espionage capabilities. China, just on the sheer volume and size of its economy, has become a big player. And if people, and if the United States doesn't want to do business with you, like in Africa or the Middle East or whatever, China will. And
the greatest Christmas in July for China was TPP, and no one talks about it anymore. And you know, we don't know. Hillary Clinton is such a duplicitous, flip-flopping liar that it's hard to imagine she might have gotten into office and then actually sort of been on board with TPP. We can't really know. She said she was going to oppose it. But that empowered China in ways and weakened our hand in ways that just, you know, can't yet be fully understood. But we will look back, obviously, and understand. And there was no amount of Gary Cohn's private, you know, tutoring sessions that could talk President Trump out of that.
Yeah.
And obviously that was a long time ago, but now he's obviously gone further with this other stuff to try to stand up, quote, to the Chinese. And it really imperils us in ways that aren't understood at this moment. But it is definitely true that it is just, it's advantage China no matter what.
Right. I'm going to invoke a rule here. I love you and respect you, A.B. Stoddard. I think you are among the smartest people in Washington, but I'm going to invoke the no mention of Hillary Clinton rule on this radio show or anywhere in politics, because it's so she's so irrelevant right now. She announces she's running for president. I'm going to call for an intervention, and I'm going to ask Canada to kidnap her and take her away.
And it's like such a right wing meme to always talk about Hillary. I have to stop.
Yeah, it is nothing. This is all on him right now, and this is it. You know, and or Barack Obama for that matter. I don't want to talk about anything. It's a year and a half in.
I know.
Here we are. I'm crazy.
That also extends to Barry Goldwater. we're going to make sure.
All right.
We never lift our embargoes, AB.
Thank you, AB. You can read AB on Real Clear Politics. Thank you, AB.
Thanks, guys.
All right. There she goes. Here comes Judy Pilak with the news in 2 minutes. Attention on deck. Legend in building. Attention on deck. Bill Curtis is with us. And Bill is, let me just get the shameless plug in here first, because this is really interesting. You're doing this Decades Presents 1968 series, and you're going to be doing a one a month, right? For the year 1968. Is that what I have?
It was a big year. Very big year.
Yeah.
For us in Chicago, especially.
And this is, and obviously this month is MLK. This is the 50th anniversary of the assassination of Martin Luther King Jr.
Wow.
And it's a few days away here right now.
Of course.
And when you stop, one of my earliest memories as a child was my dad. I grew up in a high rise in Streeterville, and my dad took me up to the roof of the building when I was 3 or 4 years old to see the columns of smoke rising from the west side.
Mm.
It was an unobstructed view going that way. It was just.
I'm old enough to be there. We were covering it, and you couldn't drive into the area. Or there was Roosevelt Road, there was 63rd Street, and there was Madison, without getting your car stoned. But we made a big mistake among broadcasters, because all the radio stations and TV had gotten together and said, "Look, don't report the riot, because it may send a signal to other parts of the city, and they will come join in the riot." Well, long about this time, right now, people were going home from work, and they were driving through the neighborhood. They were being pulled out of the cars and beaten, and the cars destroyed. And from there, I remember on Madison, I watched building after building torched and going up. and torched, you know, they had been filling up canisters with gasoline. Mm-hmm. So it was the Molotov cocktail or thrown in the basement primarily, and it went right down the street for 20 blocks. Wow. So, yes, you did see columns of smoke.
Right. And it was, you know, that's when Mayor Daley issued the shoot-to-kill order.
Yes,
right?
For the looters.
The infamous shoot-to-kill for looters in the West Side. And then I think it was a couple months later, his other utterance, which goes down in history, is the police are not here to create disorder. They're here to preserve disorder.
Right. Yeah.
And it was an awful moment for the city of Chicago. It was an awful moment for the Chicago Police Department. It was an awful moment just for America. Right. I mean, obviously, you know, the death of Martin Luther King had its repercussions and it is still felt to this very day. But the actual on the street damage, and as you're pointing out, the horror that people went through, whether they were living in the neighborhood and their buildings were lost, or whether they were driving through and they're getting pulled out of their cars, that there's swaths of the West Side they've never recovered.
Well, they haven't. A lot of people think that it was Mayor Daley, the elder, who didn't want them to recover because they had hurt his city. So he's not going to go out of his way to rebuild. Well, what are you going to rebuild it with? On Roosevelt Road, you have a huge FBI office. You have new juvenile detention areas.
Right, a lot of government buildings.
Yep. But who's going to go in with an investment in these neighborhoods? Now, drive down 63rd, and you've got to hand it to Harold Washington. New curbs, new streets, which really created some great new neighborhoods. But that was my hope for the Lucas Museum, which was dashed, was that 8,000 minority jobs would be working on it, and like nothing else as an investment could come right there.
That's
from
a great point, Bill. One of the things that I was actually, you know, what upset me and got me kind of riled up during the coverage of that was that fact was often overlooked about the Lucas Museum, because there were so many people weighing in about what it looked like, what these drawings and mock-ups, which may not have ever looked like that again.
No,
and there was so much architecture criticism, which is all valid and legit. And I was like, folks, what about this part here? Are people talking about George Lucas's movies? And I'm like, what you just mentioned, Bill, you know, the jobs. I want to ask you too, though.
Sure.
When you're doing something like this, when you're looking back at 1968, obviously, as you know, you're old enough to remember it. Ro and I were kids, but how do you make it relevant to the millennials? How do you tell this story? Because for them, it's might as well be a History Channel or something about World War One or World War Two. It's almost ancient history. So how do you make it relevant for today's, for the younger people who are often involved in their own protests?
Well, they
right
are.
Now, Bill.
I go to the Trump gathering at the Forum down there. Mm-hmm. They were talking about violence on the floor, and there was an old man who had thrown a punch at a black gentleman who was coming up the stairs, and that was the violence of that. And
he went to UIC when he was going to make the speech here.
I wanted to say, you don't know violence.
Yeah.
Why don't you burn the city for 20 blocks? Yeah. That's so you can learn a lot from history. Now, the surprising thing to me for that riot is that only 9 people died. Some figures show 11. 300 were hurt. That's the city. You know, I rolled into after the Rodney King during that riot. Mm-hmm. Well, you had 50 dead. Watts was 50 dead. You talk about columns of smoke. There were 10 columns throughout South Central. Mm-hmm. And they went to every corner.
Were you working in Los Angeles for the Watts riots?
Nope.
Were you here?
Oh, you mean the original?
Yeah, the original Watts riots.
I was here.
Yeah.
Yeah, in Chicago. And what they would do is go into a corner and then burn all 4 corners, which were usually the retail establishments. And I can't remember seeing a lot of neighborhoods burning.
Mm-hmm.
Here, you wiped out neighborhoods. Now, making that relevant, you know, we didn't learn our lesson not to riot. Mm. But they were different. Now, why were they different? It may be guns. You know, the number of guns that were available in 68, certainly.
And the type of firepower.
Yeah, to, what, a big what difference. Time. I mean, I hate to think what would happen.
That's true. And of course, just a few months after Martin Luther King, of course, we had the, you know, the convention here and all the disturbances. And the same thing. I mean, they were horrific and there was violence. But when you watch film footage, when you see the photos, it's billy clubs against fists most of the time. It's, you know, or, you know, someone might have pulled out a knife. But thank God, you know, there weren't automatic weapons in Grand Park.
From that gathering at Balboa in Michigan, I also happen to be standing on a car. I watched the whole thing.
Basically Forrest Curtis here. Yeah. Forrest Gump. Anything that's happened in the last 50 years, Bill was somewhere nearby.
That's really true.
I must never have been on the air. I was out there. But you didn't have a lot of injuries from that. You had some blood, bloody nose, but... You didn't hear about the big injuries. Mm-hmm. So we get to the conspiracy trial. I was also at the conspiracy trial. And they were, Foran, the prosecutor, tried to introduce, well, they were throwing tennis balls with nails in them and sacks of, feces. I never saw any. You may have had some of that, but it certainly wasn't in a line and throwing. These guys were sitting down, the demonstrators, and then they tried to go forward with the Poor People's March through the police line, and boom.
That's when it all
happened. It happened.
Now, we should mention that tonight is the premiere of the Martin Luther King special tonight. It's on CBS 2.2. Right, so you can at free air. You just go to 2.2, but check your local listings for cable and satellite.
338
on Comcast. Yeah. It's Bill Curtis presents decades presents 1968 Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. And this is this month's
special documentary.
Yeah. And then it moves on to, obviously, you'll have one about the riots, right? Mm-hmm. You'll have one about, will there be one about Bobby Kennedy's assassination?
Bobby Kennedy, I'm not sure we're going to go deep into that, but he was only in June, you know, his assassination.
And we think about 2018, and we think about how wacky this world is right now and how wacky America is. And you have to stop and think about what happened in 1968 between the death of Martin Luther King, the subsequent riots, Bobby Kennedy, who had just won the nomination to become the Democratic candidate for president of the United States. He is at his acceptance speech, essentially, is gunned down. You then have then at the Democratic convention here in Chicago in August of 1968, the riots that changed the world, and then all of a sudden there's Hubert Humphrey's like,
Kennedy's final public words were, "It's on to Chicago," as he said from the podium. "On to Chicago we go."
Right.
And of course, he famously, the night Martin Luther King, the afternoon Martin Luther King was assassinated, he got off a campaign plane. And there was a big rally, and as Bill mentioned, it was a different era. So he had to inform the crowd that Martin Luther King had been assassinated.
We thought the world would never be the same. It was a world turned upside down. It was the whole world is watching. Yeah. Remember that chant?
Yeah.
Watch tonight, and it's 338 on digital, because we start at this day, the 3rd, when King is getting ready for his sermon in the Ebenezer Baptist Church. And it wasn't Ebenezer, I guess, it was in Memphis, but he was going to give the mountaintop speech. And Jesse Jackson was there, and I just heard him in the show say... there was something different about it. He said, I may not be with you in the promised land, but I can assure you we'll all get there.
Let me get your assessment of this, too, because there's been a lot of reporting now, obviously, on the 50th anniversary about Martin Luther King kind of lost his way a little bit in terms of the fire in his belly for what he was doing. You know, the thing had moved. Obviously, the Civil Rights Act had already been passed. The movement was moving in a lot of different directions. Anti-Vietnam War was one of them. He was obviously getting pinged all the time by the FBI in terms of them watching what he was doing and in his personal life. And there were a lot of people around him saying, maybe he was tiring of all of this. And so I have a new perspective on what that meant when he said, I might not get there with you, meaning he may have pulled himself back away from the movement. Am I wrong in a sense?
He had changed in his mission. What do you do if you win the revolution? So he had switched to poverty being a cause. Mm-hmm. And That's one reason he came here. The Vietnam War was weighing heavily because it was being fought by probably a majority of black soldiers.
Absolutely.
So he came, and Marquette Park, they were throwing rocks down there, and there was a big fear that he was going to be hit, but he was not. But in Memphis, that speech and Jackson saying, it just was like he reviewed his life and reviewed the civil rights movement and then came to that point where he said the promised land, almost as if he is seeing the future.
Wow. Oh, tonight, stuff. Bill Curtis, Decades presents 1968, Martin Luther King Jr. That's on CBS 2.2 or 338 on Comcast.
A good memory.
Yeah, I don't really think I do. Thank you, Bill. Thanks, appreciate Bill, it. Right always. Now, Judy, what's coming up at the bottom, at the top of the hour? Hill Street Blues theme, Stephen Bochco, the genius behind so many television enterprises from the 80s and 90s, has passed away relatively young, 72. He'd been battling a rare form of leukemia for the last number of years. And just a moment on this. Maybe there'll be a little bit more of it later on in the program. But
okay.
But Stephen Bochco, to me, created two of the greatest cop shows of all times. NYPD Blue, I think, goes down. A lot of people want to say it's The Wire. I get why they want to say it's The Wire, but The Wire had the advantage of being on cable, had the ability to to do a lot of things that you can't do on broadcast TV. NYPD Blue got away with it all. As a matter of fact, got away with it so much that the Tulsa television station refused to show that because of the premiere of NYPD Blue. Showed the bear keister of Dennis Franz getting shot while he was in bed with a prostitute, and Tulsa said, "That's it, we're not going to do it." And now look what's happened. But what that was as great a television show as there ever was, I think, about police. And there is, and it came from the incredible genius mind of not only Stephen Bochco but David Milch, who was the writer of the show, who created his own iambic pentameter, his own pacing of very language to create this universal language for cops. So it could have taken place anywhere in any city in any major metropolitan in the world.
Well, I think NYPD Blues, you mentioned, and Hill Street Blues, you mentioned The Wire wrote. David Simon, who created The Wire, would tell you it probably wouldn't exist if he hadn't seen those groundbreaking shows, which had the language and the realism that you didn't get from shows, tons of great shows before that, but it was a different level. They looked like a small 48-minute or however long movies every week, right? And so many actors that you saw, on those shows went on to big careers. But just as you mentioned, the writing, David Milch, I think went on, might have been involved with The Sopranos, I believe, after that. Did tons of shows.
Milch was involved with Deadwood.
Deadwood, okay.
Right. And he was the creator of Deadwood.
And Stephen Bochco also created one of my favorite, those like almost one and done shows or shows that never had a chance, a show called Bay City Blues. And it was about a minor league baseball team. And I think it aired for 4 episodes. And it was great. It was Bull Durham before Bull Durham, but it just didn't find the audience, But I agree with you. I think Mr. Bochco was a genius. I would have thought he's much older. So he was in his late 30s, early 40s when he was creating those shows.
Right. Amazing stuff. Mm-hmm. And the characters were developed in a way that you were dealing with things that people hadn't been dealing with in episodic network television until that. Alcoholism was a major theme in Hill Street Blues, and then from Hill Street Blues into NYPD Blue and all the other stuff. And I get, and let me just, the other thing, I think the greatest trick of all times, of all those shows, was because at NYPD Blue, they kept losing their main characters, guys would go off to do other things.
Yeah.
Right? Because you had David Caruso decided after the first season, it's like, I'm too big for this show. which worked out for him. I mean, he ended up having a really long career.
And he's the first to admit he was an idiot, but that year he thought it became the David Caruso show, and he didn't realize.
Right.
For a while there, I think like spoofs of Cops, they would do David Caruso imitations where the guy would stand with his hands on his hips looking up. I don't know what it is, but I don't like it. I don't like it one bit.
That's true. At least he was the one guy that didn't have a New York accent, though, on that police department. That was the only thing that does it. Then Jimmy Smits. Went on to do the West Wing afterwards, and then to the greatest trick of all times, Ricky Schroeder. They take the kid from Silver Spoons and they made him not only a gritty character but believable and great. I mean, it goes to his acting capability.
He became Rick Schroeder, right?
Right. Yeah. But he was great in that show, and the great Dennis Franz, who's, you know, it's interesting about him.
God,
he basically has gone into semi-retirement. After that.
Yeah, we really haven't seen a lot of him. I think that's his choice, right?
Sure. Chicago actor. I remember seeing him in an off loop show back in the 1980s, early 1980s.
I think the first Bleacher Bums, or certainly the one that was on PBS with Joe Mantegna, or one of the first ones, yeah. But yeah, you could go see, you know, go to a theater, you know, go to a stage play for $2, and there would be Dennis Franz on stage.
Right. And so I'm playing king and something. It was like a dinner theater, almost a dinner theater-esque event. And there is playing a king. And then a couple years later, I'm like, hey, that's the...
Wow.
But he's gone and obviously, you know, been one of those guys, too, has been involved in a lot of like pro-police charities and things in the aftermath of it. But it didn't really want... I don't think wanted to work all that much afterwards.
Yeah, you know, well, good for him. You know, balanced life. I remember the premiere of Hill Street Blues, which really took people by surprise and was critically, you know, lauded. And remember Hill and Ranko? They were the black and white cop team, and the one guy, Hill, the black guy was, you know, former college basketball player, played by a former college basketball player, and then Ranko was kind of racist. And they, in the last scene of that, they were shot and killed, but they decided to bring them back after the pilot got picked because they were so popular. So it turns out they were both just really, really badly wounded. They had to kind of go with that, you know. But it was because they were like, wait a minute. Because I guess, you know how this stuff works better than anyone. Like they tested or found out that they were the two most popular characters. And they're like, turns out that they miraculously survived.
I will point out, people always say about, and Stephen Bochco talked about this a number of times. People will always talk about the opening of Hill Street Blues, and Chicagoans think Hill Street Blues, the Hill Street precinct is in Chicago because those are scenes shot on the near north side in Chicago. That would have been about Oak Street and Orleans is where they shot those.
Back and look at that. Yeah.
Under the tracks there. In an era they shot that, by the way, which is an era in which you didn't want to put, that was a very, very rough neighborhood. It still has its moments, but that was a really tough
Cabrini
part of town.
Was still up and everything.
Right? Yeah, and they shot around that using Chicago police cars because there was a fire sale to Universal in 1979 when they were shooting the Blues Brothers here.
Yeah.
And I believe, if I am not mistaken, there was at least two indictments that came from this, that both City of Chicago and state trooper cars were sold to the production companies, dozens of them, for that movie, and then were subsequently used a number of times. And so, they shot those using those cars. And there was probably a guy in jail at that moment watching, going, I sold that car. He was trying to tell his Sally, I sold that car.
You're so right. And so, yeah, so when people see the opening credits, the Chicago police cars, because I always say to people, where's the hill? If you think this thing is. And I remember that too, Ro, because I actually had a buddy of mine, who somehow ended up with a state trooper car from 1979 in an auction. Yeah. And he would drive it around. And it still had a lot of the markings and stuff, and the big whip antenna and the big giant lights. It didn't say, and it was great for him. My friend, by the way, he's long gone, but he enjoyed the marijuana a lot. And he said, he never got pulled over because cops just pulled up to him, kind of giving the nod. Hey, how you doing? Unmarked. Okay. Hey, how you doing, officer? And he's not here.
Stephen Bochco, I think it's a moment to stop and remember him and his incredible contribution to television, I think to law enforcement in a lot of ways. I think that, you know, that by making cops real and human as opposed to just heroic, which a lot of shows made them, you know, Adam 12 and Hawaii 5-0 and
Dragnet.
Things like that. George Dragnet tried to make them heroic and not flawed and not dealing with the ravages of what their experience really is.
That's a great point. Yeah, and those shows, you know, we got to see home lives of people. You mentioned alcoholism, the shooting victims dealing with a PTSD type situation where they didn't want to go back on the street, interracial relationships, you know, all kinds of groundbreaking stuff. You'd see, you know, top detective talking about the fact that he couldn't pay his bills, you know, that because of the divorce he was going through, all of that sort of thing.
The real stuff.
Police brutality. I mean, the good and the bad. But as you mentioned, the human side of things. Great shows.
And a police commander dating a district attorney. Who ever heard of that?
Wow, that's crazy stuff. And then Kim Delaney was on All My Children, did a naked scene, and as a young up-and-comer watching the TV, I said, what's happening here?
Oh.
It wasn't just Dennis Franz who did the nudity.
Oh, yeah. And yes. As a matter of fact, NYPD Blue was the sexiest cop show that was ever on television. Yeah, there was a lot going on there. I mean, it's sad. I think it was sad for Tulsa and sad for the rest of America that we had to see Dennis Franz Keister up in the air.
Oh my gosh!
On network television, but it changed everything. And the language that they would use, was groundbreaking. So Stephen Bochco, the genius behind that, and so many other television shows. But I mean, he'll be remembered for those two specifically. You know, it's an incredible testament to a life's work, and.
One quick, I know we got a break, but I also remember there was a Hill Street Blues episodes where there was a comic who kept getting into trouble and the cops were trying to help him and his name was?
Vic Hitler.
That's right. And they said, did you ever think about changing your name? He goes, from Victor? No, Vic. So you remember, look at the power of that writing in that situation that we both remember this 30 years later. Right?
Vic Hitler.
Yeah. Never quite got that name on the marquee. Chuckles in Pittsburgh.
See, the thing is, that was from 19, I got to say that was like 1982, 83, something like that.
Probably.
Or 81, 82. I cannot imagine, you know, you thought, oh my God, that's just crazy. Today, a guy could probably go and get on a marquee as Vic Hitler, and then there would be a gigantic social media backlash to it. But then he'd have people defending him.
Yes.
I mean, this is what social media has given us now. The ability for, no matter how bizarre or obtuse or insanely inappropriate something is.
It's true.
We always find people who will defend it, and then people who want to just protest it, no matter what it is.
Tiki torch merch in the lobby.
God. All right. Like, you know what we need to do right now? We need to check in with Judy Pylock. What's coming up at the bottom of the hour?
Make the most of life after 50 with Prime Expo, a free event for active adults on April 14th of April. That's going to be. That's coming up pretty soon, actually.
Right.
You can learn more about that, row where? At PrimeExpoChicago.com.
Check in with our friend Steve Stone coming up in just a little bit.
Okay.
He's in Toronto, where the White Sox, undefeated White Sox, are set to take on the Blue Jays tonight. Coming this evening on your 720 WGN. And it's very exciting. It's very exciting. Although, we'll ask him about this coming up. The number one prospect of the White Sox, Eloy Jimenez.
Mm-hmm. Number four prospect in all of baseball.
Right. He's still got that muscle strain.
Yeah, pec injury. Fortunately, he could still hit 30 injuries with just one pec, or 30 homers with just one pec muscle. So
that's it. We'll see what happens.
Kev got a pec injury over St. Patrick's Day in Hoyston. He went to the left hand after a while. A little strained pec there with the big leaded glass
over
mug.
Over and over, yeah. Yeah, that'll get you. UCL actually, injury to any Tommy John after the consistent
press conference. Yeah. Kevin Paolo, WGN Sports. What's a pec? First question. Follow up.
Is that near the breast?
First of all, congratulations on returning safely from San Antonio and getting out of there before tonight, before the Philadelphians arrive to go totally bat poop crazy about Villanova.
Oh, that's right. They still have a game, don't they?
And
that's
the Michiganders. Right. I'm very. I would say it was nice. And it was nice that Sister Jean made it back here too. I was a little worried about her. And did you see all of the people beating her up on social media about leaving 2 minutes before the game, which they always do? They always wheel her out.
Jeez. And plus, she didn't leave. She was just kind of brought into the inner tunnels to get away from the madness that is courtside after a game ends. It's like cameramen and reporters and people, production teams.
They're calling her a fair weather nun?
It's like, give it a break. Hey, San Antonio, by the way, outstanding host city. Everything's walkable. You can walk from the stadium to the Riverwalk. Great town.
People love that town.
It's great.
It's tiny, though.
It is tiny. You can see it all pretty much.
The camera, the helicopter shot that over the stadium shows you all of San Antonio.
Yeah, people tend to think it's bigger. Huh?
Yeah. Well, they got an NBA game. They had an NBA team there. So you got that. You got that going for you. I'm excited. Tonight's game is going to be quite good. Watching Villanova, it was sad to watch Loyola give up a 10-point lead.
Lose so quickly.
But Michigan is one of those elite college programs.
Absolutely.
Hard to get past that. But Villanova may be the best college basketball team I have seen. They are unbelievably good. They've got everything. Everything.
And they're making it look pretty easy so far.
Yeah. They are something special to behold.
I'm actually, and so it's the Villanova Wildcats, right? And
correct.
The Michigan Wolverines. There's this place in Chicago where I'm actually going to watch a Wildcat against a Wolverine in a back alley tonight. I can't tell any more about that. It's not entirely legal, but just to see. I think that'd be a good matchup. Wildcat versus Wolverine.
Villanova's beating teams, to Rose's point, they've beat teams by an average of 17 points this tournament.
They're averaging 87 points this season.
Yeah, like
87 points this season. That's like an NBA average. Right.
That game was over in the first, and then you can, college, you can make comeback stuff, but that game against Kansas was over in the first 4 minutes. It was really, you could tell it was
22
over.
22-5, you blinked, and it's like, what? 17 point game?
And it was never, and the rest of the time, it was just, it was like the NBA All-Star game. Yeah. All right, let us now check in with Judy in 2 minutes. Yep, it's the Rokan Show with Anna DeVlantis right here on 720 WGN. Kevin Powell joins us down in our main studio here as Steve Stone joins us on the Super Celebrity Hotline. He is north of the border. He was able to swipe his passport and get into Canada. And he is getting ready for our undefeated Chicago White Sox taking on Toronto Blue Jays tonight in Toronto. And I think there's, first of all, I got to say, I like, obviously, the way they won their opener, it puts you in mind that maybe some good things are ahead for this season.
Undoubtedly, there are good things are ahead. I mean, this is a ball club that has a lot of youth, has a lot of speed. I mean, you know, obviously there's some bangers that don't have speed, but there's speed up and down the order. So what you have to like so far is the fact that they've come back in their two games. I mean, they've come back in both of them to win. There's only three undefeated teams in all of baseball, and the Sox are one of those teams. So, yes, I mean, a small sample size,
but we like it
happening to this team.
Yeah, but we like it. It's all good. They have a lot of fun. Here's the thing, though. At the beginning of Cactus League play, we were talking to you about this prospect, the number one prospect that the White Sox have, number four in all of baseball, is Eloy Jimenez. And I am on a strained muscle watch with him. I'm willing to send crews of people down to massage his pectoral muscle, whatever it takes to make sure that he's okay, because I cannot wait to see him come up this season.
Well, okay, then we'll start calling him Eloy, because that's what he calls himself.
Okay.
And I gotta wait to see him come here, because I think when he does, he's going to dominate. And one thing that you bear in mind, when a guy starts to play in the United States and play a professional season, a lot of times, very early in their careers, they have little nagging injuries because they're not used to playing this many games. They're not used to a huge spring training. They're not used to 162 if they're in the major leagues, not used to 140 or 142 in the minor leagues. And so their bodies have to get used to it. You can intellectualize it all you want to about the strain and everything else, but you can't duplicate the amount of games that you have to play if you're a professional player. That's why all of these guys, in fact, Lewis Roberts, the same thing. Little nagging things have plagued him because, you know, he comes right out of Cuba. He doesn't play all that many games. And all of a sudden, you're on a schedule here that's very difficult to deal with physically. And although there's many advantages to playing in the United States, you've got great trainers and great strength coaches and everything that goes with it, you've got to teach your body how to do it on a daily basis to be a professional player. And they're going to do that. And they're going to be able to do it. And don't forget, when Abreu came here, he was already the finished product. I mean, he works very hard and does very well, but he was the finished product at his age and experience level with all the international competition. These real young guys are not. They will be, but they're not. So we have to be a little more patient with them, not only on the physical aspect of the game, but also on the intellectual and the mental aspect of the game. When it all comes together, Eloy Jimenez is going to be a stud.
You know, Steve, you make a great point. You see that sometimes with the younger players who come over from Japan because they don't have quite the grueling schedule that they do at the major league level here. I want to ask you about a guy, Steve, I think I know you're a big supporter of, who sometimes gets a little bit lost in the shuffle because we talk so much about the prospects, and then we talk about the all-stars like Abreu, and that's Tim Anderson, who might be my favorite player. I just think he's got, I mean, he's already had, you know, we've seen the power he has, but I think he's got so much upside. He's still, I think, only 24, Steve, and he's got all the tools, and he's got some pop on his bat.
Well, we knew that last year. In fact, we saw last year, I think he hit 17 home runs or something like that. And it went up to him opening day. And I said, Tim, I'm going to really enjoy every one of your between 25 and 30 home runs this year because I believe that's what you're going to hit. You really can't teach exit velocity, and he has as lively a bat as just about anybody in the lineup. Avi is special as far as exit velocity, and Abreu at times can do that. We're seeing Moncada able to do it also, but a little more quietly than the rest of the guys. Anderson has that. He is enormously strong. You can't really see it all that much, but he's got that in him. What's going to happen with him is he has unlimited range, wonderful on pop-ups, very fast, a great and a prolific base dealer if he wants to be. What will happen to him is he's going to get steadier in the field. He's not going to make those lollipop throws to first base that wind up in the dirt, leaving the whole pressure on Abreu to pick it out and save him. But he's very young. He has extreme athletic ability. He was a special basketball player who decided to make this his sport. We are, as a White Sox organization, eternally grateful for that transition because he's going to be really good. He's getting better every day. And right now, combination of Anderson and Moncada is something we should see for a whole long time. As a duo, as the middle of the diamond, the keystone combination, they're going to be great.
Very fun. Hey, I want to ask you, I was watching all of this. Otani made his major league debut. Phenom that was the entire world was it was almost like there was an international trade deal. So I'm surprised there wasn't a tweet about this international trade deal to get this guy to end up now as an LA Angel. But
with the tariff, you know, we get him a little cheaper.
Yeah, exactly. But then you never know what they're going to throw another 25% on top of him. I don't know. Anyway, I'm watching the coverage of him yesterday. And as a guy who, you know, made his bones as a pitcher in Major League Baseball, Steve Stone, I mean, how much pressure could they put on this guy? Every pitch, it was like ESPN was breaking in on every pitch. Wait a second, that was 97 miles per hour. I mean, what, the poor guy, what do you do?
Well, you know how much he cares about that? As much as you guys would care about a boil on, let's say, Jason's arm, that's how much Otani cares about whatever distracts him from his job. As a professional guy who has to hone both skills, which is really difficult, we're talking about hitting and pitching. You know, there are some very good hitting pitchers, but Babe Ruth was Babe Ruth, and that's that. And, you know, a guy that had the all-time record for scoreless innings in the World Series, a guy that won more games than most people would like to win, as a pitcher, suddenly became one of the most prolific hitters in the game. I mean, certainly, if you're looking for the greatest player in the history of the game, you have to look at Babe Ruth because he could do everything. So with Otani, my feeling, against just my feeling, I look at him as a hitter. I think that he's got a lot of soft spots. I don't know if he's going to be able to do that. I look at him as a pitcher, and I think that's where the real stardom will come if, in fact, he can adjust to a United States pitching rotation.
Yeah.
In Japan, for the most part, you throw once a week.
Yep.
And that's pretty much it. Here, if a team is doing it right, you throw every 5 days. They want their stars every 5 days. It's very difficult for the pitchers from Japan to come here and adapt to that philosophy, and or adapt, excuse me, to that philosophy, because it's different for them. I think he can star as a pitcher. I saw a collage of his breaking ball the first time he used it. And bear in mind, he threw a lot of B games, a lot of inter-squad games. He did a lot of stuff on the sidelines. But that curveball was special. He throws 100 miles an hour with a curveball that the nose-to-toes can't hit the ball thing. So if he just concentrates on that aspect of his game, I think he's got stardom from a pitching standpoint. I think he will be just another hitter from a hitting standpoint. And I do believe that the Angels will finally come to the realization, if in fact they haven't made a contractual obligation to allow him to do both things, if it's in the hands of Mike Scioscia and the Angels, I believe eventually they will come to the realization that he's got to really concentrate on pitching here, because it's so specialized and it's so difficult. And we're going to talk on the broadcast tonight about the different baseball starting in the middle of 2016, because the commissioner has said that it's the same baseball, folks. Well, guess what? It's not. And there's graphic proof of it.
Yeah.
And I mean graphic proof from the All-Star game of 2016 until today. The ball has been flying out of the park consistently, and it's not just launch angle. And suddenly, all of these great pitchers didn't get bad starting the middle of 2016. We're going to show you tonight just exactly what's happening.
Go get him, Steve Stone!
And we're gonna show you something's happening here. Break into Buffalo Springfield, and that's going to be the broadcast.
It's on Channel 9 tonight, by the way, I should point out.
Steve, another young, promising arm for the White Sox makes his season debut in Reynaldo Lopez. We saw a little bit of him last year, 8 starts or so. Where do you see him projecting long-term for this rebuilding team, and what do you think he needs to improve on this year?
Long term, assuming that the rotation is the rotation that, you know, we're looking at, including some of the young guys, and Carlos Rodon comes back, and maybe eventually you see Michael Kopech, and all of a sudden, you know, Giolito is the Giolito that we've seen. I mean, look how Giolito battled when he didn't have his good stuff, and yet he kept his team in the game to win that ball game in Kansas City. And that was Giolito without ability to get the curveball over the plate. When he gets it over the plate, hitter's not going to have much of a chance, but I love the fact that on his worst day that we've seen in some time, he was able to hold the Kansas City lineup right there and coast the heroics of Castillo and the rest of the boys. They wound up winning the game. They couldn't have done it without Giolito on a terrible night for him, holding him there. So eventually with Lopez, I see one of two things. If Dylan Cease can pitch, and nobody really knows how the rotation's going to shake up, I see Lopez eventually as a number five or as the long guy in the bullpen like Hector Santiago is now, a guy that can protect your pitching staff by going 3 or 4 or 5 innings if need be, and a guy that can get you an out if need be because he's got very good stuff. So those are the two things for me. But yet again, I mean, if this guy has a light turn on for him, his arm is good enough, his talent is good enough, where maybe he's a middle of the rotation guy. I just don't know, but I think ideally you want him at number five or in the bullpen, and all of a sudden you see a rotation that right now is one of the soft spots of this club, eventually become one of the big pluses. And if that happens with the speed and offense, this team wins the World Series. I can see it. I can see it. I think, what is it, 2020? Yes. 2020, good vision, and
good
also
vision.
A World Series.
Everybody. White Sox 2020. All right. And Eloy Jimenez, and I will get that right from this point forward. Eloy Jimenez is, you know, will be the MVP of the 2020 World Series. There you go. There you have it. I just added to your prediction.
Okay.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank
we'll see you tonight on TV.
Take care. We look forward to it. Have a good show.
All right. Steve Stone right there. And, of course, White Sox baseball coming your way on Channel 9 and also right here on WGN Radio in the 6 o'clock hour. All right. Let us now check in with Judy Pylock. What's coming up at the top of the hour news? It's a Rokon Show with Anna DeBlasis right here on 720 WGN and off for a couple of days. Richard Roper is in the studio with us.
Right here.
And we have, listen, I got exciting stuff here because it being 5 o'clock and all, that means only one thing that really is of great import that happens in this hour anywhere in the world.
It's the top five on the Rokon Show.
Five.
Let's go.
Four, three, two, one. Now, it's the top five at five on the Rokan Show with Anna Tavlantis. Sponsored by the Hip and Knee Center, where they help you feel new again.
Yeah.
Ready?
Yes.
Yes.
Get on with it.
Checking in at
number five.
Cuts. They're saying cuts there. Right. No more cuts. Those are teachers in Frankfort, Kentucky, the capital of Kentucky. And you know that only because you had to take that test in eighth grade. Hmm. Tens of thousands of teachers calling for pension reform and more education funding. There was also a similar scene in Oklahoma City today as that state slashed education funding by an estimated $180 million over the last decade. Outside the capital back in Kentucky, Stephen Johnson explained why he was there.
We're fighting for the past. All those teachers that have already retired and are worried about their pensions. We're fighting for the now, which are the people that are teaching right now and are very worried about how students are going to get all the resources that we need. And we're fighting for the future. All the new teachers and all the future students, we are all focused on the same goal, which is funding and supporting public education, which is a public institution. It is for everyone. It's part of our democracy. It's part of being an American.
Well said. You can tell it's a teacher there, too, because you got 3 points, right? Yeah, very well done. And you felt, you know the reporter wanted to say, is this going to be on the test?
It is.
Laid it out nicely there.
It is an interesting moment here where I was never much into this whole conspiracy about public education being cut just to keep people dumb.
Of course not.
I really wasn't. But the older I get, the more I wonder if it's true. Because if we're going to invest in something, I mean, this is the reality. If America is really a constellation of corporations and it's really about the gross domestic product, that really is the unspoken job one of America, which it has been for the last 100 years, then we need to have an educated workforce. And if you don't have an educated workforce, you're going to get beat out by our global competitors. And I think that this is something we do have to focus on paying attention to. And there must be ways to do it.
I think so. And teachers have all, you know, look, this is one of the most shocking things. We can talk about the change in public opinion about journalists over the last couple of generations or even police officers. But to me, the most shocking thing is that there are so many people with negative tweets and opinions about teachers, where the vast, vast, vast majority of people who go into education to become teachers do so out of the best intentions. And there's so many people who just rip on teachers.
And it's funny because people hate teachers, but they like their teacher. They like the teacher that's teaching their kid, or they like their teacher. It's crazy.
So strange.
It is crazy. You know, everybody knows. You know, every parent knows. There's that one parent in the classroom that causes all the trouble. And then maybe they find another parent that kind of goes along with the trouble.
That's true.
And everybody else is just like, would you just support what's going on here? And it's their fault, really. That's who we should be marching against, that one parent. Ugh. And you know who you are.
My goodness.
And if you don't know who the person is in the classroom who's the one bad parent who's causing all the trouble, and I don't have to tell you the bad parent that forgets about their kid, because that's a bad parent too, but the bad parent just gets in the way of everything, then you're that parent.
Well, it's because the first time their precious Brody Kenilworth comes home with a less than perfect scorecard, report card, and they're like, don't they understand he has ADD, ADD, ODDD, BDCD, FG? It's a known condition.
But the problem is that teachers are teaching to that now. They're teaching around that. That's how good the training is for the teachers. We need to make sure that they are properly compensated and trained. Drive me nuts. Don't get me started.
Number four.
Overcast skies and temperatures in the 40s. President Trump declared it was a perfect day at the White House for the Easter egg roll. 30,000 parents and children participated. They're going to let 30,000 strangers on the lawn of the White House? Is that number right?
Back on the Andrew Johnson days before he got impeached, when he would just go nuts.
That's fake news right there. That couldn't be 30,000 people. Mm. It's a big lawn, but it's not that big.
Well,
that's a stadium.
Listen, 5 billion people came to the inauguration. He knows how to fit huge crowds into relatively limited space.
Did you see the picture though? He's up on the portico, and he's or that little whatever that is,
the Evita balcony.
Yeah, the balcony, right? Mm. And he's staying there with Melania, who was absolutely stone faced, and then the Easter Bunny. Did you see the look on the Easter Bunny's face?
Yeah, the Easter Bunny with glasses.
Right. The Easter Bunny was like in shock.
Oh,
like,
geez.
What am I doing here?
I think that was spicy. Because remember, wasn't he the Easter Bunny a few years, like during the W administration? Would that be great? Steve Bannon, maybe. I don't know.
somebody who's in trouble at the
could
White
be,
House.
Could be one of his. Yeah. How do we know?
You know,
Hope Hicks got back in.
I think it's Jeff Sessions.
Ears provided.
Here's what the president said.
Also, I want to thank the White House Historical Association and all of the people that worked so hard with Melania, with everybody to keep this incredible house or building or whatever you want to call it, because there really is no name for it. It is special. And we keep it in tip-top shape. We call it sometimes tippy-top shape. And it's a great, great place.
Even the rabbit is looking at him. The bunny rabbit, the Easter bunny, is looking at him going, really? Did he just say tippy-top shape?
Well, he also said, this building or house, there's not really a name for it. There is a name for it. It's called the White House. They've got a name for it. He said there's no name for it.
All right. Judy, what's coming up at the bottom of the hour?
A little night baseball in the frozen north. White Sox baseball is back as they battle the Blue Jays in Toronto. That's tonight at 6 on WGN TV Sports.
Checking in on the top 5-5 at
number 3.
Oh, and very lucky person who I hate bought a Mega Millions ticket. I bought a Mega Millions ticket. I bought $40 worth of Mega Millions tickets. And what happened? Nice. Did I win? No.
Oops.
One ticket won in New Jersey. And why New Jersey of all the places? $521 million!
Wow. One person, huh?
One person.
Wow. Aww.
I know. And after taxes, and they take their cut, and blah, 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 if you want a one-time payment, you know, it's like, it's still like $380 million.
I could work with that.
Yeah. Yeah. Wait, what? I'm sorry, 317. Still, fine. Really? I thought we had a new tax code in. Whatever the new tax
classic
code.
Classic Uncle Sam stealing your auto.
What is that?
Winnings.
Where's Trump on that? That's seriously more than they would normally take.
Imagine all the tanning they could do in the Jersey Shore with that.
Hey, I know.
The winner
and laundry.
The winner is Meadow Soprano, actually.
All right, so we don't know who the winner is, but we do know that the Luke Oil Station in Riverdale, really, Amir Crass was the is. He sold the winning ticket, and here's what he said.
This is life-changing money, and here's what we're going to do about it. I promised my employees before realizing the amount that they were all going to get a bonus, and we're going to keep to that. A portion of the winnings is going to be donated to a charity that is close to my heart.
Yeah, that's $30,000, right, that he got for selling the winning ticket?
He should get more than that, too.
Yeah.
He's it doesn't seem like a lot.
Yeah, it doesn't seem like a lot to be giving away to everybody, and plus a charity.
He's giving a dollar to 30,000 people. That is not life-changing money, Amir.
You each get $100.
Yeah,
you can have either a Slim Jim from the snack rack.
Pick any pack of gum
or
on
some,
me.
Some wiper fluid.
Hot dog? Everybody want a hot dog?
All those hot dogs.
Oh, off the roller?
Not those new ones, the ones from last night.
Yeah, last night? Ha!
Not the all beef ones, all right? Not the all beef.
All right, check it in.
Number two.
It's no secret that Stormy Daniels had talked about her alleged affair with President Trump before signing her non-disclosure agreement. But apparently one of the people who heard it was Seth Rogen. What? He spoke with Ellen DeGeneres about when she was in his film Knocked Up.
When you ask a porn star who they've been sleeping with and the answer was Donald Trump, it was like the least surprising thing that she could have said. And so, yeah, she had mentioned it, actually.
Wow.
She did mention it. And again, it wasn't that surprising. And then as his campaign rolled out, it became clear that no one cared about anything he did.
Right.
And so it didn't really occur to me even that it would come out or anyone would care about it. But then when I saw it, I was like, oh, yeah, Stormy told us all about that.
I forgot about her role in that film.
And then there was this question.
Why is she in two different movies with you? I mean, you just, she did well?
Well, no, yes. We, in our movies, sometimes there was two scenes in strip clubs, and we realized it was easier to hire, like, porn stars to play strippers rather than get actresses to play strippers who were not in porn. Because if for Stormy, that was the easiest thing she did all week. Right. And so, like... If your goal is to be a more mainstream actress, it's perhaps a step down. But for Stormy, it seemed lateral at worst.
That's a good thing. That's why he's a producer as well. These little behind-the-scenes things.
Checking in at...
Number one.
Stephen Bochco. Strong-willed writer and producer who brought gritty realism and sprawling ensemble cast to the small screen has died. 10-time Emmy winner. Began at Universal Studios in the mid-1960s. Bochco's time and time again refused to bend to network chiefs or the standards and practices executives, otherwise known as the censors. He earned rare creative control during his five decades of envelope-pushing work. He was behind the scenes of such iconic series as Hill Street Blues. And the greatest cop one-hour procedural drama ever on television, network television, NYPD Blue. Just that opening alone. That opening alone almost made you dizzy.
Got you excited, though, for the next episode, for sure.
That's true. And I think people will forget that he was also the guy behind Doogie Howser. And then there were a few others along the way. L.A. Law.
Great.
That's another place where Jimmy Smits smoldered. Nicest guy ever, too, Jimmy Smits, for a big star. Musical tribute to Stephen Bochco. We were talking about this, that Dennis Franz, who, of course, you know, made NYPD Blue. He was the star there, playing Sipowicz. He actually played the almost exact same character in Hill Street Blues in a short arc as Detective Sal Benedetto, who takes himself hostage at the Hill Street Station.
Corrupt cop, right?
Yeah. And then...
But Franz was so good, I think they decided to write a bigger role for him as a more sympathetic and complex character in the next one. Good stuff.
Stephen Bochco and the dozens and dozens of writers and producers that went on from him to create great television is, you know, one of those unsung heroes of Hollywood. Mm-hmm. Changed the way that television looked, and certainly the way the police were portrayed on television in a way that I think a lot of police appreciated, because it was a real look at what their lives are like on and off the job in real circumstances, the toll that takes on them and their families, which I thought was his greatest contribution in so many ways, and it humanized police work and showed the characters, you know, some of them, warts and all, some of them with great heroes and some of them great tragic heroes and others flawed. But Stephen Bochco, dead at the age of 74.
The top five at five.